Okay. Well, God's blessings and love to you all. The last time on Wednesday, Bob taught on Acts 22. And Paul got in trouble. He even got himself arrested by going to Jerusalem when the Holy Spirit told him not to. I have to admit to you that I have had a don't go to Jerusalem moment myself. Probably many, many of those. But there is always a but God moment too. He still stuck with Paul and he stuck with me. So to prepare for this teaching, I knew I wanted to use the Walter Cummings working translation of Acts 23, which is the next chapter we're going to look at. And then I wanted to start my sharing with reviewing Acts 22. So I went directly back to that chapter to make a summary of what happened. But God had been in the back of my mind telling me to go back and listen to Bob sharing on Acts 22 first, which he did last Wednesday. So finally, this morning, I went back to find it on the conference call. And lo and behold, it was titled Acts 23. So my first thought was, oh my God, I've got the wrong chapter and all this preparation I did. So, but God urged me to go ahead and listen to it. And what do you know? It was chapter 22. So it was just mistitled. Had a typo. So you see here, I crossed out my whole other part that I was going to share. It didn't really make sense after I listened to his. And it was a wonderful teaching you can go back and listen to, but it's not 23, it's 22. And especially at the end of Acts 22, he relates Paul's story to our lives and how we should be thinking of ourselves as God's masterpieces. So if you go to chapter 22. I'm going to read the last two verses. Then straightway they departed from him which should have examined him, and the chief captain also was afraid, after he knew that he was a Roman, and because he had bound him. On the morrow, because he would have known the certainty wherefore he was accused of the Jews, he loosed him from his bands and commanded the chief priests and all their council to appear and brought Paul down and set him before them. So basically the Acts 22 is, Paul, don't go to Jerusalem, but I still have your back. So that's the last two verses. So I found this little video. It's kind of oriented toward Jesus Christ, but it tells you a little bit how the government of the Jewish people was in those times. So Daniel's gonna put that on for you, and it talks about the Sanhedrin. It's only a minute long, so it's pretty short. So hopefully you can see it. I have it on the TV as well.
The chief priests and the whole Sanhedrin were looking for false testimony against Jesus so they could put him to death. After they brought them in, they had them stand before the Sanhedrin, and the high priest asked, "So, just who are these Sanhedrin, and what part did they have to play in the death of Jesus?" The word Sanhedrin comes from the Greek word Synedrion, which means council. The Sanhedrin were responsible for upholding the Jewish law and were the judges of Israel. It was Israel's court of law. This court of law wasn't a creation of man, but rather of God. Right back in Numbers, more than 1,000 years before Jesus, God said to Moses, "Bring me 70 men from Israel known to you as elders and officers of the people. Take them to the tent of meeting and have them stand there with you." And there isn't just one Sanhedrin. Each town had a Sanhedrin or council of people to act as a court of law. However, the Sanhedrin most discussed in the Bible was the Great Sanhedrin. The Great Sanhedrin was a council of 70 men and the high priest. The 70 places in the Great Sanhedrin were filled by Pharisees, Sadducees, chief priests, elders, and scribes. And this group was the final authority on Jewish law apart from God. They all sat in one big semicircle so everyone could see each other. When they came to meet, the lesser members of the Great Sanhedrin would speak first so as not to be intimidated by other members. In this court of law, there was no prosecution. Rather, witnesses came forward to bring a case against someone. There was no defense either. The person being charged would represent themselves and could call witnesses of their own. The Sanhedrin would then confer among themselves to determine the verdict. However, when the Great Sanhedrin came to bring charges against Jesus, they could find no witnesses with valid claims. All they could find were people who brought false testimony against him.
So that's how the government of the Jews was set up. And what I thought was kind of interesting was the Sadducees were part of this group, and they were the elite of society. And they believed solely in the written law, and they did not believe in an afterlife. And they did not believe in resurrection of the dead. But the Pharisees, which is what Paul was, did believe in the resurrection of the dead, and they made oral interpretations of the law. So they had these two groups, kind of like we have in Congress, is what I thought of. So what I'm going to do now for Acts 23 is use the working translation here, so I'm going to probably go back and forth. So I'm going to start out in verse 1. And Paul, earnestly beholding the council, said, "Men and brethren, I have lived." So this is him before the Sanhedrin, and there's Sanhedrin, and there was Sanhedrin in every city. He says, "I have lived in all good conscience before God until this day." And I'm going to read the working translation, which says, "Looking intently at the Sanhedrin, Paul said, 'Gentlemen, brothers, I have conducted myself as a citizen before God with all good conscience until this day.'" Verse 2, "The high priest Ananias commanded them that stood by him to smite him on the mouth. Then Paul said to him, 'God is going to strike you, you whitewashed wall. Are you sitting in judgment of me according to the law and at the same time acting contrary to the law? You order me to be struck.'" So in this verse 3, the whited wall is an idiom, and it's used to refer to a hypocrite because of whitewash that was used to cover up defects. And in Matthew 23:27, you want to go there, but I have it written out here. It says, "Woe to you, scribes," and this was Jesus speaking, "Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you are like whitewashed tombs, which indeed appear beautiful outwardly, but inside are full of dead man's bones." So, I thought that was interesting to clarify that verse. In verse 4, it says, those who were standing by said, are you insulting the high priest of God? And verse 5, Paul said, I have not been aware, brothers, that he is a high priest, for it has been written, you will not speak in an evil way about a ruler of your people. In verse 5, similar to the expression found in Exodus 22:28, thou shalt not revile the gods nor curse the ruler of thy people, Paul's answer made use of the figure of speech irony, and it pointed out that the high priest was not doing what a high priest ought to be doing. And irony is something, language that normally means the opposite of what you mean, of what's communicated. So I asked Claudia and Al to give examples of irony. So, Claudia, do you want to, I'll take you off mute and you give your example.
Yeah, can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, so just as a little context here, irony is a figure of speech. It's closely associated with sarcasm as well. Lord knows I'm very sarcastic, so I just use it as a figure of speech. But it's interesting that they came actually from a Greek word, ancient Greek word, aironeia, meaning feigned ignorance. And irony is always, when you use irony, you're saying the opposite of what you want to convey. Having said that, I have a couple of examples for you, and Judy asked me to maybe get something a little bit funny, so I don't know. We'll see. So one of the things that right away came to mind when Judy actually texted me about this, I answered her with a statement, ironic statement, and I said, oh, I can't wait for the temperature to reach 90 degrees. Obviously, I can wait forever because if you know me well, you know I do not like 90-degree weather. So that's irony. Another one, and that wasn't that funny, but this one I thought was kind of funny. The irony of getting a job is you get a job so you won't be homeless. But when you get a job, you're home a lot less. So there's a little bit of sarcasm in that as well. Oh, somebody chuckled. Good. Let's see, another one I found is, oh, this one you guys should get. It would be ironic if a movie about the Flat Earth Society wins the Golden Globe Award. So get it? Flat Earth, Golden Globe Award. So all of these are examples of irony. Intertwined with sarcasm, and maybe one more, the most ironic part about working at the unemployment office is, if you get fired, you still have to come in the next day. Harf, harf, harf. Okay, thank you for your ears, and thank you, Judy.
Okay. So, Al?
I'm going to cut to the chase, and just simply give you two examples of irony, and they're pretty simple. The first one, excuse me, a traffic cop gets his license suspended because of unpaid parking tickets.
Oh, boy.
And the last one, a pilot has a fear of heights. There's your irony.
Those are groaners. Thank you guys. That was really sweet. Okay. So we're gonna go to verse 6. Now when Paul recognized that the one part were Sadducees and the other Pharisees, he cried out among the Sanhedrin, gentlemen, brothers, I am a Pharisee, a son of Pharisees. Concerning hope and resurrection of the dead, I am being judged. And Paul was, his parents I think his father was actually a Pharisee as well. They owned land, and so they were Pharisees, and they were also Roman citizens. And the subject of, so he was kind of stirring them up because he knew that they didn't believe the same thing. So he was kind of, you know, getting them all worked up over that. So let's see, we'll go to verse 7. And after he said this, a dissension arose between the Pharisees and the Sadducees, and the multitude were divided. Boy, that sounds familiar. Verse 8, for the Sadducees say there is neither resurrection nor divine messenger nor spirit, but the Pharisees confess both. Verse 9, so there arose a great clamor, and certain of the scribes representing the Pharisees faction stood up and contended, saying, we find no evil in this person. And another verse at the end says, but if this is a spirit, let us not fight against God. Verse 10, now when a great dissension occurred, the chief captain, concerned lest Paul should be torn in pieces by them, ordered the troop to go down and to snatch him from their midst and to bring him into the fortress. Kind of reminds me of those cowboy movies where somebody's in jail and then this big crowd is going to come and take him out of jail and go hang him. And so, but Paul was protected by the Roman person, the chief captain. So he brought him into the fortress. And verse 11, during the following night, the Lord stood by him and said, be courageous. This is a great verse because here he was not doing what he's supposed to be doing. He got in trouble. And who shows up? The Lord. During the following night, the Lord stood by him and said, be courageous, for as you have testified concerning me at Jerusalem, so you must also bear witness at Rome. And another translation of this is, and the night following, the Lord stood by him and said, be of good cheer, Paul, for as thou hast testified of me in Jerusalem, so must thou bear witness also at Rome. So God was there. God was with him and telling him what his mission was. Verse 12, when daylight had come, certain of the Judeans banded together and put themselves under a curse, saying that they would neither eat nor drink until they had killed Paul. Verse 13, there were more than 40 people who made this conspiracy. Verse 14, coming to the chief priests and the elders, they said, we have cursed ourselves with a curse to taste nothing until we have killed Paul. Verse 15, so now appear before the council along with the Sanhedrin as though you intend to examine the things concerning him more precisely so that he brings him down to you. Then before his arrival, we are ready to do away with him. Now here, God shows up again. Verse 16. However, the son of Paul's sister heard about the ambush, and approaching and entering into the fortress, he reported it to Paul. Then Paul called one of the centurions unto him and said, bring this young man unto the chief captain, for he hath a certain thing to tell him. Verse 18, so he took him and brought him to the chief captain and said, Paul the prisoner called me unto him and prayed me to bring this young man unto thee who hath something to say unto thee. Then the chief captain took him by the hand and went with him aside privately and asked him, "What is it that thou hast to tell me?" And he said, "The Jews have agreed to desire thee that thou wouldest bring down Paul tomorrow into the council, as though they would inquire something of him more perfectly." Verse 21, "But do not thou yield unto them, for there lie in wait for him of them more than 40 men, which have bound themselves with an oath that they will neither eat nor drink till they have killed him, and now are they ready, looking for a promise from me." So the chief captain then let the young man depart and charged him, "See thou tell no man that thou hast showed these things to me." Then he summoned two of the centurions and said, "Prepare 200 soldiers to go as far as Caesarea, plus 70 cavalrymen and 200 spearmen for the third hour of the night, which was about 9 p.m. and provided animals for Paul to ride that they may deliver him safely to Felix the governor." And Felix was the Roman procurator of Judea at that time. He also wrote an epistle, or an epistle is a letter, after this manner: "Claudius Lysias, to the most excellent governor Felix, greeting. This man was seized by the Judeans, and when he was about to be done away with by them, I intervened with a troop and rescued him, and I learned that he is a Roman, wanting to know the reason for which they had accused him. I brought him down to their Sanhedrin." And like I shared, each city had a Sanhedrin. Verse 29, "And I found that he had been accused about controversial issues with regard to their law, but without any accusation worthy of death or of bonds. When it was disclosed to me that there was about to be a plot by the Judeans against the man, I immediately sent him to you. And I also ordered his accusers to speak before you with regard to their matters against him." So the soldiers, as they had been ordered, took Paul and brought him by night to Antipatris, which Antipatris is a city that was established by Herod the Great in honor of his father. And what I read is that city is now Tel Aviv in Israel. "On the next day, they," the soldiers, "allowed the cavalrymen to proceed with him, and they returned to the fortress. They," the cavalrymen, upon "who, when they came to Caesarea and delivered the epistle to the governor, presented Paul also before him." Verse 34. "And when the governor had read the letter, he asked of what province he was. So he's asking Paul where he was from. "And when he understood that it was of Cilicia," which is where Tarsus was, so that's where Paul was from. Verse 35, "I will hear thee," said he, "when thine accusers are also come." And he commanded him to be kept in Herod's hall. So, the last verse, right?
Yeah.
So, what happened is Paul's going to get his day in court, so to speak, that he's not going to get killed. He's going to have to have them say, why are you against me? And why are you against me? Thus, Paul escaped the death at the hands of the Judeans by the intervention of the Roman soldiers at Jerusalem. The chief captain sent Paul with a heavily armed escort to Caesarea, where he could have a hearing before the governor Felix without the threat of the Jerusalem plot. So, that's Acts 23.